This is the second part of The Science of Sin with the British neuroscientist Jack Lewis. We're working our way through the seven deadly sins, and in part one we talked about the queen of all sins, pride, as well as gluttony and lust. Now in part two, Jack Lewis is taking us through discoveries about the brain and its relationship with the other four cardinal sins, beginning with greed. So Jack, tell us about the concept of neuroeconomics and how the brain guides my greedy tendencies.
Yeah, so neuroeconomics actually is a neuroscientific study of brain responses under conditions where someone's making sort of financial decisions. And you'll typically have a situation like the ultimatum game where someone will say, right, I've got $100, I get to choose how to split it, but then if you don't like the split, neither of us get anything. So I'll say, right, I'll keep $50 and you can have $50. And of course you'd be like, brilliant, let that deal go through, fine. But then if I were to say, all right, I'll keep $70 and you get $30, you might be like, well, that's very unfair. Like that, I don't like that. Why should you get more than double what I get in this exchange? And it's reciprocal. You take turns, deciding how the split would be made and changing roles. But essentially, if I were to offer you 70-30, under normal circumstances, if you do this over and over again, the other person would reject that split. They'd rather have nothing than let the other person get away with being so greedy. So neuroeconomics sort of found that those same brain areas I spoke about earlier, the ventral tegmental area, the nucleus accumbens, they get very much involved in establishing what is a good deal and what is not. But across hundreds of neuroeconomic studies, they looked at what is the common brain activation when people find that they are on the thin side of the deal. They're getting a bad deal. They're being offered less than the other person, and they're kind of being taken advantage of financially. Under those circumstances, there's two brain areas that always light up. There's the anterior insula, which is a little island of brain tissue buried deep in the valley between the frontal lobe and the temporal lobe. And that brain area always lights up when there's a financial inequality in the deal. But it lights up regardless of who is on the thin end of the deal. It just seems to respond to inequality regardless of who ends up benefiting from that. But there's another brain area which lights up when you yourself are on the thin end of the deal, and that is the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex again. So it seems like this brain area that was involved in that study I described previously with narcissists being socially rejected, that sense of social pain seems to come back again when any of us feel that we're on the receiving end of greedy behavior. So you'd imagine that this would be a force for kind of, you know, making sure that our dealings with each other are more equitable. And indeed, it seems that our instincts at a fundamental level, humans are naturally equitable. We share evenly wherever we can. If we'll offer to help another person, knowing that they will then naturally want to reciprocate and help us back again. But the most interesting part of this study was that, a different batch of studies of this topic, was that if you make a person make that kind of decision very, very quickly, you don't give them time to think about it, they will tend to be more generous than if you give them plenty of time to mull over it, presumably because they convince themselves of some perfectly reasonable reason for taking more than their fair share. And then another study looked into, if it's our instinct to be generous and we can override that, maybe if we switch off prefrontal areas using a zap of magnetic energy, we can temporarily switch off a part of the prefrontal cortex at the moment that they're making a decision. Maybe we can get people to be more generous that way. And indeed, that's exactly what happened. Someone actually did this study. And then it's like, then the next question is, where does greed come from? Like, it's so rife in the world. Like, how, if it's our natural urge to share equitably with other people, why the hell are people so greedy? And then another body of research suggests that people with a formal education in economics tend to be greedier across the board. And people who grew up in a very high socioeconomic demographic tend to be greedier than others across the board. So
why?
It seems that greed can be learned.
Right, okay.
If enough people tell you...
So what, you study economics and it leads to you learning to be greedy?
Economics is essentially, it rationalises ways to maximise profit. And if there's whole textbooks dedicated, if there's whole university courses dedicated to it, then it kind of tells you that society says, although it might feel a bit mean, like it might sit heavy on your conscience, executing a deal where you leave the other poor, ignorant sucker with a really, really bad deal in order to take all the profits for yourself, that this is sanctioned by society. This is acceptable behavior. Therefore, ignore those feelings of reticence to do something that's so brutally unfair because, you know, it's naive to do otherwise. And I think through multiple iterations, lecture after lecture, essay after essay, book after book, strategy after strategy, a person can eventually rewire their brain through neuroplasticity to feel like, no, you know, you can bolster those, that capacity to suppress the urge to be equitable can be actively suppressed until the point that it becomes habit. And then when you've got people like, old Trump writing in his book in the 80s, The Art of the Deal, the point is you can't be too greedy, but in a proper American accent. He actually said that. The point is you cannot be too greedy. So when you've got like people who some people look up to explicitly guiding people to be as greedy as possible, then, you know, you think, well, my instincts must be misleading me here. I want to be wealthy. Therefore, I need to suppress those instincts and maximize profit. But at the end of the day, the super rich are very rarely happy, no matter what it might seem from their Facebook posts. With huge amounts of money comes huge amounts of stress. So, that for me is the worst thing. People, they often want to have huge wealth because they think that will enable me to have amazing VIP treatment, amazing quality of life. But then actually, in order to maintain that wealth and not lose it, because they're petrified of losing it, they have to work so hard they miss out on all the important things in life.
So, Jack, let's get on to sloth. That's next in the sinful septet. Sloth, you could just call it doing nothing. Why is it sinful?
Sloth is about not pulling your weight, not doing your fair share. If you think about sort of our early ancestors hunting and gathering, why should you eat if you don't help to hunt and you don't help to gather? Like there are some people who can provide other services, like perhaps the medicine woman, you know, wouldn't have to do as much as everyone else because if someone's ill, they're the ones that keep you alive. So there's this sort of sense of people contributing fairly towards the group enterprise. But there'll always be people who, try and play the game. They try and get all the benefits, but without doing any of the work. And that's really what the sin of sloth is about. The sort of Christian forefathers were worried about. It was one particular Evagrius of Pontus out in the Egyptian deserts. So he was particularly worried sloth-wise about his fellow brothers, the monks out there, focusing on their godly thoughts, that it was very hot out there and it was very lazy and they wouldn't sort of attend to their spiritual duties just because of the heat of the day just made them feel like they were unmotivated to do so. And so, the same thing in any workplace. We all know of people who we work alongside who kind of create the impression of industry, but how much do they actually do? And modern society does kind of allow people to get away with that quite a lot. And as much as they might not get kicked out of the group altogether, they will ultimately fall out of favor with other people. And then you've got the other group who it doesn't, we're not getting paid enough, end of the working day, go home. There are people who would be willing to stay beyond because if a job's worth doing, it's worth doing properly. And they're the sort of anti-sloth people. So this part of the book digs into not just the reward pathways, but other parts of the nucleus accumbens is in a part of the brain called the ventral striatum. And then just above it is the dorsal striatum. And that's very much also connected with frontal brain areas. And that kind of evaluates motivation, putting your sort of to-do list, your goals in order and knowing what you should do in order to achieve those goals and having that sort of that burgeoning energy, that desire and drive to get the job done. And everyone's sort of striatum ticks over at a slightly different rate. And I sort of talk about how it can be quite difficult to get people motivated when they've had bad experiences of having sort of done their fair share, but then haven't got their fair cut of the rewards. That can end up leading people to be slothful, or what seems like slothful, just because they've had bad experiences of cooperative
behavior. Yeah, they're demotivated
in the past. Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, you got to get to the root cause of why someone who appears to be slothful is being slothful, because there's loads of circumstances where, like, for example, in depression, the striatum ticks over at a lower rate. And therefore, you know, if your striatum isn't giving you that level of drive, then you haven't chosen to be slothful through free will, if you like. It's kind of being forced upon you. So there are various, like homelessness. A homeless person sat on the same sort of bit of pavement begging day in, day out. They can seem unmotivated. They can seem like lazy. But it's actually more often than not a lack of viable alternatives. They don't have the choice necessary, or something to do with the passage of their life. So things that have happened to them in their life mean that they no longer have an option to work hard. It's hard. Sometimes you can end up getting kind of blocked out, and it's very hard unless someone goes out of their way to give you a way back in to finding gainful employment. So there's a lot of false alarms in the world of sloth, because sometimes the lack of drive is forced on a person. But I point the finger very heavily at sort of tech apps, which soak up a lot of people, where people choose to spend huge amounts of time playing, for example, Candy Crush.
Mm-hmm.
Like the real industry and drive going into a game that actually achieves nothing for them in life. And fine, if you want to play it for 5-10 minutes on your commute, that's no problem. But often these games are designed to be so moorish that people spend huge amounts of time playing pointless, silly games, which importantly displaces time from other activities, more social activities that would improve their well-being.
On our end, this is Life Matters with Amanda Smith and Jack Lewis, a neuroscientist and the author of The Science of Sin, Why We Do Things We Know We Shouldn't. Okay, now, next sin off the rank. And it's, well, perhaps unlike the other deadly sins, one that does feel really awful in the moment of experiencing it, and that's envy. Can, though, experiencing envy ever be a positive thing, Jack?
Absolutely, it can, yeah. So there's two types of envy, or sort of two responses to feelings of envy. Benign envy describes a situation where you spot that someone else who you feel sort of broadly, you've come from a similar background, you had a similar start in life, but they're doing better than you. And that's what causes these feelings of envy. You notice the discrepancy between them and you, and it emphasizes your shortcomings. It makes you feel bad about yourself because of their relative superiority. So benign envy describes a reaction to that feeling where you think, well, what can I do to pull myself up by the bootstraps and kind of push myself forward, you know, increase my motivation levels through that benign envy to, you know, do a course or something, or perhaps, you know, examine the way they got to their level of success and try and emulate it. You can use these people you feel envious of to inspire you to greater things. But then, of course, there's malicious envy, because the other way of redressing the balance and bringing you and the person you're comparing yourself to a similar level is to bring them tumbling down from their pedestal. And so there's a lot of kind of malicious acts where it's like, why would anyone do that? And it's actually because when someone is in the grips of malicious envy, they want to bring about that person's downfall regardless of the consequences to themselves in the future, because they can just become consumed by it. And again, envy, if you look at people who are in a brain scanner and you see what parts of their brain light up at the moment that they feel envious, guess which brain area crops up? The dorsal anterior cingulate cortex. So, you know, again, envy is a form of emotional turmoil, emotional pain. So perhaps that comes as no surprise. But it was certainly surprising to me when so many of these different sort of classic seven deadly sin behaviors all seem to come down to this same brain area again and again and again.
What about the final sin then, Jack? Wrath. Is that same?
Yep, same thing. So the best study for looking into the neural correlates of wrath, the brain areas that become especially involved when someone is feeling wrathful, is called the TAP test, the Taylor Aggression Paradigm. And I love this because it's so devious and naughty. You basically get two people and they're each wired up to an electrode that delivers a painful electric shock. But the twist is, each of them deliver the shock to the other, and they're given a dial so they can crank up the voltage of the shock to make it more and more and more painful. And so it starts off with low settings, and one person zaps the other, and like, ow, that hurt. And the other, they zap them back. They go, ow, oi, you zapped me much harder than I zapped you. There's this natural sort of capacity to feel like you've been dealt with more harshly than you dealt that other person. And so they go.
And so it escalates. Sort
of, it escalates, exactly. And so it cranks up and up and up. And what they found was, if you take the measure of how much extra voltage they applied to the other person as a proxy for the amount of revenge or retribution they were going to take, there was a positive correlation between the amount they cranked up the voltage and the amount of activity in guess what part of the brain? The dorsal anterior cingulate cortex. So it was at this point that I rejoiced because my book was all coming together very nicely. But jokes aside, it really has made me think differently about being on the receiving end of other people's antisocial behavior. And this is what I hope moving forward, people, whether they believe in God or don't believe in God, they can use this little pearl of wisdom. If you imagine what's going on in that part of the brain that produces psychological pain, turmoil in another person's mind, and when they're being antisocial, you can kind of imagine the pain that they're in, it can really help you to deal with them in a more compassionate way, rather than taking the bait and trying to fight fire with fire, which invariably leads things to escalate, and it doesn't help you personally deal with that antisocial person. And the best example of this is, I was inspired to write this book down at Speaker's Corner in London's Marble Arch, where I often go to listen to people up on their soapboxes. It's the home of free speech in Britain, and they're usually talking about religion of one description or another. And I'd often roller skate past, because that's where I go roller skating, have done since teenage years. And I heard these two people having an argument, and I thought, right, I'm going to write a book about the science of sin. So I went back there having written the book, and I spoke, I got up on my own soapbox and did a talk for an hour, pretty much similar content to what we've just discussed over the last little while. And about 20 minutes through this, it's 11:30 in the morning on a Sunday morning, this really drunk and disorderly bloke comes through, and he's like effing and blinding and throwing abuse at me for no reason, just generally being disruptive. He really made my blood boil, and I didn't know how to deal with it. I ignored him, but inside I was really suffering. And then afterwards I sort of expressed my dismay that I hadn't applied the learnings from my own book to my own behavior, because I treated him sort of in quite a terse manner. And I didn't let him sort of derail my speech, but I was annoyed that I hadn't been a bit kinder to him, realizing he must be in some kind of pain. You won't believe it. I went back 3 months later, told the same story, explained how last time this guy came with being disruptive, and I was disappointed with myself for having not sort of been a bit more compassionate given what I discovered in the writing of this book. And he only turned up 5 minutes from the end. And I jumped off the soapbox, ran over to him, gave him a big hug. I was like, so great to see you. I was hoping you'd come. And it was amazing the effect it had on him. It completely disarmed him. He didn't see it coming. He melted in my arms. It's really weird. But he was like a puppy. He was just so happy. He just needed a little bit of, he'd probably been kicked from pillar to post his whole life. He'd had a sequence of bad things happen to him, which made him such an angry person, but it immediately diffused him, just immediately offering friendliness. I know I probably sound like some huggy hippie now, but it actually worked. That was an experiment. Obviously N equals one. There was only one subject, but it worked brilliantly.
Yes, you're going to have to repeat it a few times. But Jack, as an antidote to antisocialism, to being sinful in your own life, you do take inspiration actually from a text that everyone used to have hanging on the back of their toilet door, and that's the Desiderata. Now, that poem, why? How do you find it helpful to
move placidly amid
the noise and haste?
Speak to all people, even in the dull and ignorant, for they too have their story. So it was written by this guy, Max Ehrmann, between World War I and II, I think. thereabouts. And he wasn't religious himself, but I just thought it was a really lovely poem for expressing excellent advice that has stood the test of time, that is secular, you know, whether you believe in God or not. He actually, one of the verses expresses that, just sort of feel like you're a child of the universe and you belong here as much as anyone else. It just had the right balance to me of practical advice. It's not preachy. It's just sort of offering some good ideas on how to get the best out of all people and reminding to sort of ground you in your community. And at the end of the day, that's what I want to keep from religion. Religions are brilliant at building communities. Science isn't very good at building communities, you know, local communities, making a person feel embedded. So whether you go with Max Ehrman's poem or whether you go with some but not all of the teachings from the books of religion, anything that can help us feel more firmly embedded in our communities is good for our physical and psychological health. And it's always important to remember also that peace is not the absence of inner turmoil, but the ability to manage it.
You are a child of the universe, Jack. I've learnt more about the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex than I ever expected to in this conversation, and a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Jack Lewis is a neuroscientist, also broadcaster, podcaster and writer, and he's the author of The Science of Sin, Why We Do the Things We Know We Shouldn't, joining us from London. This is Life Matters.